FIS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
There are a number of critical metals and ingredients that are part of the technologies we all use today, and we're going to discuss at least three very important ones, which, if we are just in the first leg of a longer-term bull market in all sorts of commodities, well, you definitely want to pay close attention to what our next guest has to say. Rick Mills is the author of the Ahead of the Herd newsletter at aheadoftheherd.com. Rick, let's talk about the three kings of electrification and decarbonization.
When you look for an investment, you kind of got to take a bird's eye view of what's going on in the world. And I think if you kind of do this top-down approach, what you see is two dominant long-term global themes. First one would be electrification / decarbonization. We want to electrify our transportation. We want to decarbonize our transportation. And of course, we want to get into renewable power. So that's one of the dominant long-term themes that I see. The other one is inflation. And if you talk to a lot of the experts or you listen to the talking heads, you get the theme that inflation is transitory. It's all COVID. That's wrong. We're going to prove it's wrong in our talk today. We're gonna show that inflation is not transitory, but it's rather sticky. So let's get going with the big three of electrification and decarbonization. So you know what your top down is. Now you want to get bottom up. You know there's long term themes at play, and so you want to kind of look from the bottom upwards and find out where to put your money. And what I've looked at and where my money is a lot of into copper, lithium, and graphite. And I call them the big three, and we'll get into why here right away. I mean, with copper, I mean, if you think about copper, nothing happens on the electrification or the decarbonization side without copper. If you don't have enough copper, you simply can't build your EVs. It takes four times or five times more copper in an EV than an ICE powered vehicle. Your charging stations, millions of your charging stations, your smart grid. I mean, you put your solar and your wind where the wind blows and the sun shines. You've got to get it somewhere. You've got to have a smart grid. That's copper. You're not going to be substituting aluminum. Aluminum is so power intensive to get it from bauxite to aluminum. And of course, we have a power crunch going on, and we'll explain why that's not going to go away. So you've got copper. Nothing happens in the electrification and the decarbonization without copper. Unfortunately, we have a rising demand in the face of a huge structural deficit. We simply don't have enough copper coming online in the near term, the medium term, or the long term to supply all the copper that we need. We've got other factors impacting our copper supply, like resource nationalism. You look at Chile, you look at Peru, you look at the DRC, Zambia. These are four of the top copper producing nations in the world. And to some extent or another, governments are expropriating, they're increasing taxes, they're putting royalties on it, on the deposits and the sale of ore. They're stopping the sale of raw ore, and they're making you benefact it in country. So we've got that. And the easy fruits would pick, Chris. You've got to go further and further afield to find deposits, which means your infrastructure's lacking. Deposits are also suffering from a lower grade. They're deeper. They're more remote. The metallurgy is more complicated, which means it's more expensive to extract the ore. All around, you've got a huge demand facing a supply crunch. And when you consider that it takes 10 to 20 years to bring on a new mine, we've been lacking in exploration funding. So we've got a real shortage of development projects in the face of a supply shortage. So it, all around, it's a perfect storm for copper. And not only copper, we'll get into the other two metals here shortly, but for copper, we're under a crunch here, and it's just not going to go away.
Yeah, Jeff Currie at Goldman Sachs has labeled this as the revenge of the old economy, right? We've seen structural underinvestment across the commodity complex and in the mining sector now for a decade or more. A lot of money just funneling into mostly big tech. And so there's been now a setup where we see a structural supply deficit. This was something that you were talking about last year on our show and even prior to that. How we're seeing this, you know, a major setup, a perfect storm. And I mean, gosh, 2020 was really the major inflection point. Speaking to copper, you know, we bottomed in early 2020 after the COVID crash, right around $2 a pound. And just within the course of a year or less, it spiked to more than double that price, overtaking the 2011 high. So what a dramatic turnaround in such a little time for copper.
Yeah. People are realizing that, well, there's an awful lot of predictions about where demand is going and where supply is going. And you see them anywhere from we need another 10 million tons of copper production per year by 2030. Other predictions say that we need to double our copper production. We need to go from 20 million tons to 40 million tons by 2040. And I'd just like to take a very conservative estimate, and let's say that we need another 10 million tons of copper production per year between now and 2040. So in 18 years, we've got to up our copper production per year by 50%. Now, when you look at the numbers, we actually have 200 mines closing over the next little while. When you look at mines like Tallahassee, the bigger copper mines, they're going underground. They're ramping up production. But let's keep in mind that's not new production. That's just replacing what's been lost. So let's go a little further and let's take a look at where our new production of copper is coming from. And that's from five of the big mines. And a world-class mine in the copper industry is anything over 200,000 tons a year. And there's only five of them. There's nothing else after these five come online that is anywhere near that size. So you've got 80% of copper supplies in these five mines. The one in the DRC, Kamoa, is the largest. By the time it ramps up production, it's going to be a million tons a year. Okay. And the other ones, they're going to add about a million two. So what we've got is we're going from a little over 20 million tons a year, and we're going to go up to call it 22 million tons a year. That's a far cry, considering there's nothing big on the horizon coming into production after these five. That's a far cry from 30 million tons a year in 8 years.
Yeah, well, like you said, too, if we do find another discovery, a big discovery of copper, it's going to take a long time to bring that into production.
Canada, 20 years. The U.S., you'll never get it into production. I mean,
right.
The boundary waters are closed down. Pebble's closed down. The Constitution is closed down. They put an 8% mining royalty on new mines. And the point is that to get to just the 30 million tons, which by 2040, which is an extremely conservative estimate, you've got to find 12 and a half Kamoas. I mean, it's crazy, you know, because they got ramp up and they're going to lose some production from acts of God or whatever strikes. So you've got that. I mean, you're just not going to make it with the copper, even on the conservative estimates. And we never talked about all the infrastructure programs going on, which is copper intensive as well. But it gets worse, Chris. I mean, it gets a lot worse. When we talk about global copper supply, we're talking about global copper supply, okay? So But you got to get down into the nitty gritty on who owns that copper. And the head of the herd did, and nobody's done this before that we've seen. We wanted to know who owns the copper from those five big mines coming online. Okay, Kamoa, the biggest one, like I said, 1 million tons when it's fully ramped up. That's China. The West is never going to see that. That is not going into the global market. China has an offtake agreement. The DRC has an offtake agreement. That copper is going to China. If you look at the other mines, the vast majority of it is going to China, Japan, and South Korea. So when we look at copper, global copper supply, we have to understand that that copper is tied up long before it gets to production. It doesn't go to the global market. That copper's flowing east. It ain't heading west. It's not available in the global copper market for sale. It's already tied up. So it's worse than people think.
So basically, Rick, it sounds like we're seeing the same kind of dynamic that we see with coal and natural gas right now. Every country, you know, Russia, it's trying to make sure that it has its own domestic needs met for production of natural gas and its inventories, which are running low, before it ends up shipping it off to Europe. So each country is basically, hey, we're going to hoard everything that we can get because we're in a shortage. We see the structural supply deficit. Demand has increased. And so this is true not just for energy, but it sounds like this is true for copper and then other critical key metals and resources as well.
Yeah, it's wherever you dabble in the metals and you look at who's locked up supply, China is dominant. I mean, they control not quite the half of the world's copper supply. They do most of the smelting. They're very copper dependent. And when we get into lithium here, I mean, obviously, you can't make a lithium-ion battery without lithium. And China controls most of the lithium processing and makes over 60% of the world's lithium-ion batteries. And lithium's price has exploded as demand has soared.
Yeah.
In an investor's presentation, Rio Tinto said if they had another 60 JADAR mines, that wouldn't fill the supply-demand gap. They're calling for EV sales to be on track to hit 55% of the world's total vehicle sales as early as 2030. That's 65 million units. That's 3 million tons of lithium in 2030 compared to 400,000 tons that we produce today. Hmm. And remember, China controls the copper. They control the lithium. They make most of the world's batteries. So let's remember that as we go through this. If you had all existing operations and future projects combined, that's only 1 million tons of lithium compared to the 3 we need in just 8 years. Focus in on the U.S. They want to build. It's obvious President Biden's pushing his clean green agenda, electrify the transportation system. He wants to have 100% clean new vehicles by 2040. So let's just look at the U.S. They've got 5,000 tons a year of lithium production from Albemarle Silver Peak in the Clayton Valley, Nevada. That's the only producing lithium carbonate mine in the U.S., according to the USGS. Bloomberg NEF shows 5.3 times more lithium is needed in 2030 compared to current levels. Now, I made a mistake earlier. I'm sorry. Biden wants half of new vehicles sold in the U.S. electric by 2030. How are you going to get there? I mean, you've got Tesla has got its gigafactory in Nevada. They're building a new battery plant in Texas. GM's building a battery plant in Ohio. SK Innovation is building two battery plants in Georgia. Volkswagen, GM, Mercedes, Ford. Pretty much every car maker in the world plans to electrify its fleet. Currently in the U.S., there are 11 startup, EV startups, going to build, like Rivian building their pickup. They're going to build EVs and in the U.S. I mean, that's an awful lot of U.S. growth depending on China batteries. And it's just ridiculous to think that the U.S. can continue to depend on China, increasingly adversarial in politics and trade and militarily, for its critical metals.
Yeah. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Now, when you're talking about lithium, as you probably saw, Gavin Newsom signing a bill to ban small gas-powered lawnmowers, leaf blowers, and other equipment. And there's quite a large number, millions of devices, they say more than, you know, the number of cars on the road. And so you're going to see this switchover, if that ends up going through, you're going to see a switchover from a lot of these smaller gas engines over to batteries. If California puts this through, and if you see other states comply as well, that is going to be increasing sizable amount of demand for lithium. We also see battery packs increasingly being included as part of microgrids on houses. So the demand for lithium is increasing. And just like with copper, we've seen a vertical spike from 2020. So long term, what is your view on lithium? Do you think that we've moved too far, too fast? Maybe we're going to see a consolidation. What are your investment thoughts on it?
Well, all the infrastructure money is pouring into lithium. Lithium batteries, there's talk of other chemistries. You know, you add a little nickel, subtract a little cobalt, maybe go to solid state, maybe an iron air, zinc air. You know, but the fact of the matter is that lithium's a first mover. All the infrastructure being built is lithium centric, like your batteries and everything. There's going to be more technology come along and different batteries. But when you, like, I mean, Toyota just said they're going to spend $3.4 billion on batteries in the U.S., lithium ion batteries. You're not going to be moving away from lithium-based chemistry anytime soon. So is lithium a good investment? Is lithium to be one of the big three? Well, yeah, it is, and it's going to continue to be. Nobody's going to suddenly pull the plug on $3.4 billion here and a billion there and a couple billion there to switch to another chemistry that doesn't involve copious amounts of lithium. I mean, there's 70 kilograms of lithium in the Tesla S3. Nobody's going to suddenly switch that. You can't. There's nothing close to being ready. And again, you've got to burn out your infrastructure that you spent so much money on before you'd be willing to switch.
Rick, where are most of the deposits located for lithium?
Well, most of your brine is in the lithium triangle, Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile. Bolivia is a basket case of resource nationalism. Their lithium is too low grade. It's too contaminated. It spread so far out. Various companies and stuff have tried to work with the Bolivian authorities, and it just ends in failure every time. Argentina is an economic basket case. They do have lithium. It's not as dry or as windy, which you use for evaporation in the brines, but Argentina's a place for lithium. The main one is Chile for brines. And as we know, Chile has got water problems, power problems, resource nationalism is starting to creep in. They actually had a communist leading in their elections this year for a little while. So that's pretty much it for the brine. When you look at hard rock, you have Australia is probably the largest spud of mine. And that comes out of the country and into China as a 6%. And then it's got to be refined up. It's very expensive for battery grade. It's much more expensive than brine. And then in Canada, you've got a lot of hard rock mining. You've got some companies trying oil field brines, but they're 4,000 meters down and it's expensive to pump up, and you've got to pipe it to a central collection state, and it's very, very, very contaminated. You've got to clean it up. So your lithium is concentrated in Australia, and the lithium triangle with Chile being the favorite spot, and of course hard rock in Canada.
Okay. Full disclosure, I own the lithium ETF, LIT, and I've been a holder of that for a very long time. I know that you like to play particularly in the junior mining sector, so a bit more high-risk area. Let's move on to graphite, because this is, again, part of this trifecta, this the three kings of electrification and decarbonization, as you've been discussing. Tell us a bit about graphite, how it's used, and what are some of the properties that make it so essential?
Well, we all know you can't make a lithium battery without lithium. But, Chris, did you know you can't make a lithium ion battery without graphite?
That I didn't know. I didn't know graphite was necessary for lithium ion batteries, no.
Yeah, it's the only material that can be the anode. There's no substitution at all. You can add a little silicone for density, but you cannot literally build a lithium ion battery without graphite. There is no substitution. Zero, zilch, nada, none. And graphite's a critical metal, and in pretty much anywhere in the U.S. for sure. And it was just added to the defense material stockpile list. So the U.S. Is going to start to stockpile graphite so many tons a year. It's actually easier to get lithium in the U.S. than it is graphite, because there is no graphite production in the U.S. As a matter of fact, the only graphite production in North America is 10,000 tons from two mines in Canada. All graphite is, most of it's, the majority of it is mined in China. All the refining for battery grade graphite is done in China. So the weird thing is you want to build a mine, the battery, the EV supply chain in the U.S. and build everything there. Well, you're not going to have the copper. You don't have the lithium, and you sure as hell ain't going to get the graphite, because 100% of the graphite you need for all these places we just talked about building batteries, your anodes are all graphite, and you got to get it from China. They're the only place that produces it. So we keep getting this repeating theme of China all the way through.
Yeah, I'm actually reading here. China is the top producer, like you mentioned, the world's largest graphite producer in 2020, according to the most recent data. It put out 650,000 metric tons, accounted for 62% of world graphite mining in 2020. So that's pretty significant. Like you say, there's a major bottleneck there with China on a number of these different metals.
Very much. I mean, you've got two things going with graphite is that it's just not, it's not mined in the U.S. There's no U.S. production in 2019 and 2020. And they get all the supply from China. It's more than a bottleneck. I mean, you've got China dominating green and clean from lithium to graphite. They've got nickel locked up out of Indonesia. They own cobalt from the DRC. They've got the rare earths tied up. I mean, China dominates the clean and green battery metal space. Now, one thing more about graphite is the use of lithium ion batteries is projected to gobble up well over 1.6 million tons of flake graphite per year. Now, this is a scary number, 1.6 million tons of flake graphite per year. Now, this is when the global total of all graphite, and I mean, that stuff used in pencils, it's used in nuclear reactor liners and all this stuff. So all graphite in 2020 production globally was 1.1 million tons. We're going to make so many lithium ion batteries that we're going to need 1.6 million tons of flake graphite per year for the anodes. I mean, that number is scary, but it gets worse for graphite as well, because the USGS believes that large-scale fuel cell applications that are being developed. Now, lithium, let's explain something. Lithium ion is going to be for everything, like you mentioned, your laptop, your cell phone, your lawnmower, your EV, for your house power. There'll be large batteries for renewable energy storage built out of it. But fuel cells are coming, And fuel cells aren't so much for individual cars for people to be driving around. But what they do is large-scale central fueling stations. Like if you want to convert your fleet of electric buses, FedEx could maybe, you know, if you're running 200 fuel cell vehicles, you'd have one central fill-up station. And that's where the hydrogen comes in. So the USGS believes large-scale fuel cell applications, the central filling stations being developed, they could consume as much graphite as all other uses. You've got a White House report on critical supply chains. This was just out. It showed graphite demand for clean energy applications is going to require 25 times more graphite by 2040 than was produced worldwide in 2020. So I think we've made a pretty good case, Chris, that copper, lithium, and graphite, when you do your top down and then you go into your bottom up, you definitely find that these are three, to me, must-own metals in our rush to electrification and decarbonization.
And Rick, would it be safe to say there's quite a bit of attention on copper, clearly, because of the move that it's seen? A little bit less so on lithium, but increasing amount of attention on lithium is given what you already discussed. Graphite seems to be still a little bit off the radar for the general public.
I agree 100%.
So maybe there's still a bit more of an attractive opportunity there on the graphite side, just because it doesn't seem like there's as much attention being paid to it or much investment flowing into graphite yet.
Well, the graphite's a tough one because only large flake spherical graphite, and you have to process it a little bit. It has to be coated. Can be used for our batteries, right? And that is not every deposit. And even if you do have that large flake spherical, it's not a major component of many deposits. So you've got to be careful with your graphite. I mean, basically, you've got to be careful with your lithium. You've got to be careful with your copper. It's not just any deposit that's going to work. Not just any deposit. I mean, you want to pick the lowest cost deposit that's scalable. And we're going to talk about three companies here. And we're going to talk about one in the copper, one in the lithium, and one in the graphite. And what you'll notice on each one of them is that it's high grade. It's metallurgy is uncomplicated. They're in areas where you can get infrastructure where you don't have green problems. And the most important thing, it's scalable. And we'll get into the scalable. The first company I want to talk to about copper is Max Resources. And we've talked about Max before. It really hasn't gone anywhere. The company continues to explore and find new deposits. The land size they've got is incredible. The copper and the silver grades, you know, I think they're off the charts. They've found so much in the elevation changes, the rolling topography just tells me that it's got considerable volume. So I like Max Resources. It trades under the symbol MXR. I like them for copper, and I like them because of silver kicker. We know silver is photovoltaic, solar power. We need silver. So I like Max Resources for the copper and the silver. In the lithium, you've got Cypress Development Corp right in Nevada. It's actually next to that lithium producer we talked about, Albemarle. And what I like about Cypress is that they've got a 40-year mine life on just 1/6 of their resource. They can supply 5% of the world's lithium from what they have now. So they're a price maker, not a price taker. And this thing is easy to scale up. I mean, they're looking at so many tons over 40 years on a sixth of the resource. If a major wants to come in there, they could scale this up to whatever production they want to suit their bottom line and the markets at the time. So that's why I like Cypress Development. It trades under the symbol CYP. The graphite is easy for me. It's Graphite One, GPH. It's in Alaska. The size of their mine from their PEA could supply nearly all the U.S. graphite needs. Again, it's only on a small part of their resource. I think by the time they update their resource, do their pre-feas, we're going to see that they can supply all the U.S. graphite needs. And their graphite is specially suited for batteries, lithium-ion batteries for EVs. And this company isn't just going to be a mine. They want to put together a graphite product manufacturing plant. And again, that's Graphite One, GPH. I mean, a couple honorable mentions in the nickel and copper would be Palladium One, PDM. They've also got cobalt. An interesting play for nickel and copper sulfides is Renforth, RFR. And again, silver, Magna Gold, MGR, and Dolly Varden, DV.
And Rick, just to point out, I believe you are particularly concentrated and investing in the junior mining space. Would all of these companies that you listed, are they all within that category?
They certainly are. And I own shares in every one. They're also advertisers on my site. They pay me to advertise on my site. But whether they're paying me or not, I'd be invested in juniors in this sector for the electrification and the decarbonization. And we've had quite a price rise in all these metals that we're talking about. And historically, when you have a metal price rise like this, when you have a commodities bull market, your greatest leverage to rising metal prices are these juniors. There's a time to own them and there's a time not to. And for me, what we've seen since the last time we talked and even the first time we talked, we've seen a huge price increases. And the shares of these juniors really haven't moved that much. But let's remember, we've got the inflation story. We've got the China-centric for all these metals. We have to develop our own in-country supplies. And we've got increased demand with structural deficits in almost all of them. So I think junior resources, time has come. I think we're going to see a nice move in the stocks of our junior resources that own these clean, green battery metals.
Now, Rick, I do want to ask you a question based on something that you'd mentioned earlier about how you don't think inflation is transitory. You think it is sticky, and it's going to be much more on the persistent side. That aligns with our view and something we've been talking about for quite some time. And then you also said you don't believe the energy crunch is going to be going away. Do you mind touching on both of those and sharing your view with our audience?
Well, let's look at the energy crunch. I mean, we had a mass move from fossil fuels to renewable. And so basically what you have is a very quick knee-jerk reaction switching from fossil fuels to renewables. And Germany's probably the poster child for it. They shut down their nuclear power plants. They shut down their coal. The nuclear power was a knee-jerk reaction to Fukushima. The coal was a knee-jerk reaction to pollution, to renewable energy. So they shut down those two power sources. And before long, they were buying coal-fired power from Poland and nuclear energy from France, trying to make up for the fact that they hadn't invested enough in renewables to cover the drop in fossil fuel supplied power.
They just shifted their carbon emissions to another country, right?
Pretty much. That's exactly what they did. And this too early shift from fossil fuel-based energy to renewables is happening throughout the world. I mean, think about all the renewable power. Hold up one finger, and that's all the renewable power generated in the world. To replace all the power generated by fossil fuels, you'd have to have 2,500 fingers held up. So you need to get 2,500 times more renewable energy than there is now to replace fossil fuels. So we made some hasty decisions. We went down the path a little bit too quick, and we put more money into clean and green than we have fossil fuels. And now we're paying the price. You've got an energy shortage in China. Coal and natural gas prices are going to record highs. You've got power rationing, triggering concerns that households and factories are going to be left without power just as winter sets in. And I mean, in Europe, the winter last year was much colder than normal, and it depleted gas inventories. Electricity prices soared. Demand from rebounding economies surged too fast. Supplies couldn't keep up. I mean, the price of natural gas in Europe is 6 times higher than last year, and it's even 4 times higher than it was just in the spring. I mean, that's nothing new for the European Union. It imports 90% of its gas. Russia's the largest source at over 40%. And I mean, they constantly accuse Russia of holding back supply to keep prices high. And that's been going on, especially this year. Energy market dynamics, you're just being overshadowed by fossil fuel energy generation to go from fossil fuel energy generation to renewable power sources, namely wind, solar, and supply. There's not enough coming online quick enough to replace the amount of fossil fuel power we're dumping. And it's not going to change. This is going to keep going. People are divesting themselves of funds that float into fossil fuel, coal, oil, and gas producers or pipeline infrastructures, and you're trying to bring on renewables to replace the lost output. It's not going to happen. You can't do it quick enough. We jumped the gun. We're going to pay the price. The problem isn't about to sort itself out anytime soon, Chris, because even though solar and wind are getting less expensive, most parts of the world still depend on coal and natural gas as primary source or as a backup. The biggest example that we got is the United States. 40% of the country's electricity is now generated by natural gas. Higher gas prices are inevitably going to push up electricity and heating bills. U.S. natural gas futures are already more than doubled this year. And one of the reasons is, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, power consumption is projected to increase 60% by 2050. Think about that. We need 2,500 times more renewables to replace fossil fuel. In the meantime, power consumption is going to increase 60% in 28 years. Again, a crunch. We're not going to get away from this.
From your standpoint, you're long-term bullish on these three kings of electrification and decarbonization. So copper, lithium, and graphite. You listed some junior mines, of course. Got to keep in mind with the caveat, though, to all you listeners, that is a risky space, very speculative, see very big moves up and down. So obviously keep that in mind if you're looking at any of these companies. And as well, you don't believe, you know, inflation is transitory. You think that this is much more persistent, which according to our view, we think we are going to be seeing above average inflation levels for the remainder of this decade. And in addition, the energy crunch, you don't see necessarily going away as well, just given resource nationalization and some of the larger factors at play. Does that about summarize what we discussed today, Rick?
Yeah, I think that's very accurate, Chris. I'd just like to add in that I'm not a broker. I don't give investment advice. I'm not qualified to. I'm talking about my opinions and what I own. If I was listening to this podcast and I was interested, I'd contact somebody like you or a broker and get advice from somebody licensed to give it.
Well, Rick, I do want to point out that you have an excellent list of articles and research at your website going into depth on all of these things, citing, like you said, the U.S. Geological Survey, posting a number of different reports and research. And so with that said, can you tell our listeners the best way to follow your work?
Well, I think the best way to follow my work is to come to the website aheadoftheherd.com and sign up for our newsletter. Come on to one of our social media feeds where we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and just read along. There's plenty of stuff to read on all kinds of topics, in-depth research. I think you'll find it very enlightening. At least I hope you do.
Rick, it was a pleasure speaking with you again. The website is aheadoftheherd.com. Go and check it out. And we definitely look forward to speaking with you in the future.
The The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.